the sixth sign, and we're going to be reading from the book of John, if you want to follow it in the church Bibles, or it will appear, I hope, on the screen. Wow, there you go. And it's Jesus heals a man born blind. And this is what it said.
Born blind. His disciples asked him, "Teacher, whose sin caused him to be born blind? Was it his own or his parents' sin?" Jesus answered, "His blindness has nothing to do with his sins or his parents' sins. He is blind so that God's power might be seen at work in him. As long as it is day, we must keep on doing the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." After he had said this, Jesus spat on the ground and made some mud with the spittle. He rubbed the mud on the man's eyes and said, "Go and wash your face in the pool of Siloam." This means sent. So the man went, washed his face, and came back seeing. The neighbors then, and the people who had seen him begging before this, asked, "Isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "He is the one." But others said, "No, he isn't. He just looks like him." So the man himself said, "I am the man." "How is it that you can now see?" they asked him. He answered, "The man called Jesus made some mud, rubbed it on my eyes, and told me to go to Siloam and wash my face. So I went. As soon as I washed, I could see." "Where is he?" they asked. "I don't know," he answered. And then moving on towards the end of the chapter, I'm just going to read verses 35 to 41. And it says this: "When Jesus heard what had happened," this is the investigation that the Pharisees undertook, "he found the man and asked him, 'Do you believe in the Son of Man?' The man answered, 'Tell me who he is, sir, so that I can believe in him.' Jesus said to him, 'You have already seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you now.' 'I believe, Lord,' the man said, and knelt down before Jesus. Jesus said, 'I came to this world to judge, so that the blind should see, and those who see should become blind.' Some Pharisees who were there with him heard him say this and asked him, 'Surely you don't mean that we are blind too?' Jesus answered, 'If you were blind, then you would not be guilty. But since you claim that you can see, this means you are still guilty.'" Well, imagine, if you will, what it would have been like for someone who is able to see for the first time. Fresh, startling, new, terrifying. Generally, we don't know what happens when people first look at the world. They are far too young, and by the time children are old enough to explain, they can't and don't remember what it felt like in those first few weeks of life. Light is what drives life. It is hard to imagine our world and our life without it. And the sensing of light by living things is almost universal. But people who do not have their sight develop different sensory systems to make sense of their world without light. So they can, for example, see and perceive braille. Their brain enables them to do that. Now, as adults, they are suddenly pitched into a new world with different rules. And it can be emotionally and damaging and overwhelming. And although they can see, they often suffer what psychologists call visual agnosia. They retain their mental blindness. It's not enough to see an object. The brain needs to recognize it. So people can see a rectangular object with a brown circle on top and a loop on the side, but what they don't understand is that they're looking at a cup of coffee. In 1963, Richard Gregory and Jean Wallace from Cambridge wrote a case study of a recovery from early blindness, and they published it in the Experimental Psychology Monograph. Since the age of 10 months, this person had been functionally blind. But after surgery, he was able to read the clock in his hospital room shortly afterwards. And however unfamiliar to his eyes, it made sense to his brain. He was able to find his way around the room, able to coordinate distances. But being able to see is a complex process. It involves time, practice, mental ability. But it begins with revelation, with being able to see. But once it happens, it's a process that only works one way. It would seem unimaginable to us not to see a stop sign is a sign, or that it is a solid object placed in front of one thing and behind another. But what seems so confusing and hard to process for people who can now see for the first time becomes increasingly automatic as the brain begins to navigate and make sense of this whole new world. This incident in chapter 9 is of a hero introduced into a whole new way of being. It is a new wine, it's living bread, it's walking on water, it's a new creation breaking in. The old has gone and the new has come. He is a pioneer, and he is persecuted for that fact. He is a hero without a name, a beggar man, a man who grows fast and furious in his understanding and perception, whereas those who are able to see the world with 20/20 vision retreat back into increasing myopia and blindness. The outcast is thrown further out. But the Lord of life invites him into a new family as a child of God, to come to know God as Father and Jesus whom he has sent, to the right to enter into a new community, the right to become God's children, the true children of Abraham. John tells us in his gospel that no one has ever seen God. The only Son, who is the same as God, is at the Father's side, he has made him known. So we all share the experience of this man who was born blind. We have never seen God. It has to be revelation to see clearly and to begin to understand and perceive what God is really like. And it is Jesus who makes him known. Because although God gave the law through Moses, the real blessing is through grace and truth received through Jesus Christ. But this incident that we're going to look at is not just about revelation. It is also about judgment, of the choices that can be made at critical moments of opportunity. And when faced with the evidence before us, we choose to step back into the darkness and the comfort of our known routine world, rather the shock and wonder of the new. Because it's safer that way. We've got too much to lose. Fear and anxiety is the enemy of faith. There is not a story of giving sight to the blind in the Old Testament. And even in the New, it is only restoring the temporary blindness of Saul and Tarsus, of Tarsus by Ananias in Acts 9 that we read about. But in Acts there were two people afflicted since birth who are healed, the lame man at the beautiful gate and the lame man at Lystra. But only Jesus gave sight, as Jesus can give it. There are more miracles of giving sight to the blind recorded of Jesus than healings of any other categories in the Gospel. And in the Old Testament, the giving of sight is associated with God himself. In Exodus 4, when God responds to Moses, who is giving him a lot of excuses, who gives man his mouth? Who gives him his sight or makes him blind? It is I, the Lord. And in Psalm 146, the Lord sets the prisoner free and gives sight to the blind. But it's also about the Messiah. It's messianic. It belongs to the person and work of the coming Messiah. And it's included in the Kingdom Manifesto that Jesus announced in the synagogue in Nazareth, quoting from Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has chosen me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed and announce the time has come when the Lord will save his people." But it's elsewhere, too, in the Old Testament. In Isaiah 29, he details what will happen when the Lord will come to save his people. And elsewhere we read that he details the hope for the future. When that day comes, the deaf will be able to hear a book being read aloud, and the blind who have been living in darkness will open their eyes and see. And the road of holiness instead of the road to nowhere, where the desert is blooming in the wilderness, Isaiah says, the blind will be able to see and the deaf will hear. And the Lord's servant is characterized by the fact that you will open the eyes of the blind and set free those who are imprisoned. And Jesus fulfills this as God's Messiah by giving sight to the blind. So this incident, as John records it at this point in his gospel, is of particular significance as it demonstrates that Jesus is the Messiah. The giving of sight is one of the dawnings of the new age. In Luke 7, Jesus responds to the followers of John dispatched to check him out. He says, "Go back and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind see." Now the man himself, the man born blind, is feisty, he's argumentative, he's courageous, but he's also a harbinger of judgment. Jesus, as the light of the world, is always in conflict with darkness, as we shall see. This incident in the street comes a little while after the attempt on Jesus' life at the stoning, the attempted stoning at the treasury in the temple at the Feast of Shelters in Jerusalem, where Jesus had spoken to the Pharisees and said to them, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will have the light of life and will never walk in darkness." And as a corollary to this, "I came to this world to judge, so that the blind should see, and those that see should become blind." And it's the fact that it's another Sabbath miracle obscures the fact of witnessing a triumph of light over darkness. And when they take direct action against the man born blind, it is the first definite action of persecution of Jesus' followers, and it marks a decisive moment. It increases the tempo and leads to the crescendos of the seventh sign, the raising of Lazarus, and then the crucifixion, and then the resurrection. So let's begin by looking at a healing on the street. The healing takes some unique features. The man was blind from birth, and the means used, a paste from spittle and clay. and also that the man being sent to the pool at Siloam. Jesus first saw him. He took the initiative. And he was probably a well-known figure. The disciples knew about him and began the kind of discussion the Pharisees carried on later. They were provoked by the evidence of his plight, and they ask Jesus the reason for it. Who was to blame? If something has gone wrong, something or somewhere is to be held to blame. And many assumed it was sin as the causal factor. There is no death without sin, no suffering without iniquity. So what has gone wrong then with this man that he is now blind and been born blind? Whose fault is it? Was it his fault or his parents' fault? They both go together, cause and effect. But Jesus rejects both. Suffering is not always due to sin as a direct relationship of cause and effect. But he says he is blind so that God's power might be seen in him. Such work of God is not surprising. It is to be expected. But it is work too in which his followers have a responsibility to do as well, the work of God, which is for human beings to believe on him who God sent. And this was the answer given to the questions raised from the fifth sign that we looked at back in the synagogue at Capernaum and the controversy it caused. What God wants you to do is to believe in the one he sent. And Jesus goes on to add, we must keep on doing the work of him who sent me. And it is out of a sense of compelling necessity, it is our food and drink, that we do this. Jesus tells his disciples, my food is to obey the will of the one who sent me and to finish the work he gave me to do. Yet these works do not originate on earth, but in heaven. They are heaven-sent works in which too we have a role and responsibility that we must do, and with some urgency, as the opportunity will not always be there. But it is also a place of contest and confrontation, because the coming of the light inevitably displaces and challenges the darkness. So John, in his gospel, prepares his readers to understand that the Word was the source of light, and the light brought light to mankind. And it follows on and is evidenced here that the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never put it out. And he goes on to warn them, this is how the judgment works. The light has come into the world, but people love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. Anyone who does evil things hates the light and will not come to the light because he does not want his evil deeds to be shown. But whoever does what is true comes to the light in order that the light may show that what he did, in fact, was obedience to God. Why did Jesus use clay? Well, perhaps it was a reminder from Genesis 2:7 that Adam was made out of the red earth, and therefore, as the light at the dawn of creation, it marks a new creation breaking in. Why spittle? Perhaps it was because it was a common perception that it had curative powers. God works sometimes within what we know. Why was he sent to the wash at the pool of Siloam? Well, being sent is a prominent thought in John. Jesus is referred to again and again of having been sent by the Father. It wasn't, however, the clay or the spittle or the pool that was the key thing, but the fact he went and he washed and he came back seeing. In the passage, no questions are asked of his faith, but rather tracking how that faith grew. And it was an act of faith as he goes to wash without argument or hesitation, unlike Naaman the Syrian in 2 Kings, who did both. But the pool is perhaps more significant than perhaps we realise. It is the pool where the water was drawn for the Feast of Shelters. And the crowds participating in the festival earlier would have watched day after day as water was carried up to the temple to illustrate the promises made to Ezekiel and Zechariah of abundant water flowing from the temple to bring life to the dead lands of the desert and the Dead Sea. And linked to the pouring of the Spirit, and where Jesus had dramatically announced on the seventh day at the climax of the feast, "Whoever believes in me, streams of life-giving water will flow from his heart." So then, this man went to this rock-cut pool fed by the Gihon spring, which is sent by a channel as a sender on the southern edge of Jerusalem by the fountain gate to this pool called Sent. But what were the effects on the neighbours? Well, the neighbours were astonished. They refused to believe what had happened. They knew him, and they knew him as a beggar man. For a man born blind, there was no other way for him to keep body and soul together than by begging. And they had difficulty accepting it. "Isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?" Others were not sure it was actually him at all. He certainly resembled him. And the man born blind ends the speculation. He just simply says, "I am the man." So inevitably the question follows that he's going to be asked a lot that day. "How is it you now see?" And he has very limited information. Just that the man called Jesus, that he knew very little about, and he assumes that his hearers knew very little about, that's all he knows. It was the man, Jesus, who told him to go to the pool called Sent. And furthermore, he doesn't know where Jesus is now, because he's gone. Now, although we didn't read this, it's important to know what happened next. Because of these astonishing events, an investigation was held as to what was going on. And the investigation was led by the Pharisees, and they're called in to assess and determine just what happened and to make sense of it. And their first point of clarification, as far as they are concerned, is that this event happened on the Sabbath, and on the fact that it broke Sabbath laws, and therefore it was an illegal act. So there is a simple view, and therefore a clear judgment on Jesus who did this. The man who did this cannot come from God, for he does not obey the Sabbath law. But other Pharisees are more open, and note, how could such a man who is a sinner perform such miracles as these? It's a good question. And they become divided. So they turn to persistently question the man born blind. And given this happened to him, he has some authority to speak on the subject. So they ask him what he thinks of Jesus. "He is a prophet," is the definite reply. It's the same verdict of the Samaritan woman by the well. "I see that you are a prophet, sir," as Jesus tells her life story. He is definite. He can't be anything else. The highest place he would and could assign to a man of God. But he has, however, developed in his thinking, because he's moved from thinking as Jesus as a man to Jesus as a prophet. And in some ways, the strengthening of his faith and understanding is paralleled by the deepening distance and descent away by the Pharisees of grasping the realities that lie before them. Because they're already prejudiced against the facts. They're looking for the flaws with the man born blind and his arguments and his testimony. I don't believe it. So they haul in his parents. And sadly for them, the parents confirm that he is their son. And he is who he said he is. But they're not cooperative in saying anything else, because they fear expulsion from the synagogue, as that had been the threat that anyone who believed that Jesus was the Messiah would be expelled. And that implies that was exactly what was starting to happen, that people were believing in Jesus as the Messiah, and the authorities were rattled and cracking down. And the parents were also in the spotlight of powerful people who had the power to do them a great deal of harm. So they refused to comment. Ask him. He is old enough, and he can answer for himself. They saw the danger. The son was on his own. So he is cross-examined again, and the tension rises. They put him under oath and push him hard, but he gives as good as he gets, standing on the self-evident fact, "One thing I do know, I was blind, now I see." So far from shifting in his position, they cement it. The irony is that those who thought themselves enlightened and trying to batter him into believing what he knew to be, not believing what he knew to be true, they actually have actually encouraged him in his beliefs. So they change tack. They ignore the person who did the miracle and abstract it. They said, "Give the glory to God who wrought the miracle. Jesus had nothing to do with it." Indeed, to ram the point home, they used the full force of their institution, position and power and authority by saying again and again, "We know, you don't. We know, you don't. We know that this man who cured you is a sinner. We know that God spoke to Moses. We do not know where he, Jesus, comes from. We, the educated, learned, competent, confident people, know. Wise up." And so the restless questioning continues, and the man born blind brings it to a head. Why is he pointlessly repeating what he has already said? He has already answered their questions, and they are not minded to believe him. So he baits them. "Maybe you too would like to be his disciples," which implicitly suggests that here again he's taken a step further, that he counts himself amongst the disciples of Jesus. And at which point the investigators lose it. They abuse him and speak to him with contempt, speaking about the certainties that they have compared to this street beggar. And they say, "As for that fellow, we do not even know where he comes from." And undetermined, the man born blind, the beggar from the streets, proceeds to give them a masterclass in theology for theologians. He finds it astonishing that they do not know who Jesus is. And in effect, he's saying that the really marvellous thing here is that your unbelief in the face of the evidence is more of a miracle than my cure. What a strange thing is this. You do not know where he comes from, but he cured me of my blindness. He's using irony and sarcasm in the face of their hostility and contempt. You religious experts cannot work out a simple thing like that. And in the face of their lists of "we knows," he adds one of his own, which is more self-evident. "We know that God does not listen to sinners. He does listen to people who respect him and do what he wants them to do. Since the beginning of the world, nobody has ever heard of anyone giving sight to a blind person. Unless this man came from God, he would not be able to do a thing." but such eloquence is wasted. They dismiss it by saying it is his own fault in the first place that he was born blind, and it is the proper punishment for his sin. And they throw him out of the synagogue as a heretic and abandoning him to his fate, because he dared to lecture them. They are the proper authorities of the old order, and they, because of that, they are precisely the improper ones who cannot grasp the new unless they recognize the old is passing away. The guardians of the old established order have judged the situation in the way that reinforces their power and their vested interests. But it is a bluff. It simply conceals their anxiety and fear, so they resort to threats and insults. And this is the terrible reality of judgment. It compels those who love darkness to seek refuge in deeper darkness. If the light in you is in darkness, we read in Matthew 6, is darkness. How great is that darkness as a response to the coming of the light? But let's connect, as we come to an end, with the passage that we read at the end of chapter 9. And it's learning to see further, where John has Jesus put in context the principle that is at work here, in accepting and therefore increasing understanding of the light that is in contrast to the deepening resistance and refusal. The row and the result of it would have been common knowledge, and Jesus makes an effort to find the man who is now expelled and asks him what he thinks, not what others think. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Jesus asks the question, and he invites the man to take a step further of insight and understanding, who's already proved to be a very fast learner. The Son of Man is an enigmatic title which includes the man called Jesus, but also includes the one who is given everlasting dominion, described in Daniel. And Jesus uses that title a lot. And Daniel has a vision of the Son of Man, who he describes as, "I saw what looked like a human being. He was approaching me, surrounded by clouds, and he went to the one who had been living forever and ever and was presented to him. He was given authority, honor, and royal power, so the people of all nations, races, and languages would serve him. His authority would last forever, and his kingdom would never end." Faith is essentially a personal thing, born of experience. The man recognizes his voice, though up to now he has not seen him. It is the voice that sent him to the pool called Sent. So he greets him respectfully. "Who is he, sir, that I can believe in him?" And the little phrase Jesus uses in reply, "You have already seen him," to a man born blind, must have meant a lot. And Jesus identifies himself to him clearly, that this is the man who sent you to the pool called Sent, and you came back seeing. And he is the one who is talking to you now. So sir becomes Lord. "I believe, Lord," verse 28. And this is the climax, the process of revelation and understanding and perception that's been going on for the whole of chapter 9. The man Jesus, who became the man who stood as a prophet, the man who came from God, and who is now God to the Son of Man, the everlasting God, the Messiah. So he gives the reverence that is appropriate only to God. Yet the story does not end there. And a little later, in verses 39 to 41, there is a follow-up conversation to these events. Jesus' coming represents a judgment for people, and they divide on how they react to his coming. Whoever believes in the Son is not judged, but whoever does not believe has already been judged, because he has not believed in God's only Son. And this is reflected in this chapter by sight and blindness. Jesus coming means blind men see. I came to this world to judge, so that the blind should see, and those who see should become blind. For it is he, Jesus, who gives perception and understanding and clarity to understand who God is, and Jesus Christ, whom God has sent. And the Pharisees are incredulous when he implicates them that they are blind too. After all, they are the enlightened, the learned ones. Surely you don't mean that we are blind too. But the blindness is not of ignorance, but the blindness of claiming that they can see, which is far more damaging because they claim they know. It is more terrible because they have the spiritual knowledge to act and be more responsible. Because if they'd acted on the best of the knowledge that they had, they would have understood Jesus as he really was. But instead, they chose not to. They refused to see what they should have understood. And Jesus said, that means you are still guilty. And I'd just like us to end with a question for us to think about. Are we walking in the light? Those adults that came to see for the first time, for some of them, had to learn to see, to understand what it meant to see. Are we walking in the light, like the man born blind, a deeper and fuller understanding of who God really is, revealed to us in Jesus? The invitation and possibility and practicalities are there, but it takes time, it takes experience and persistence and learning. Just as we thought about the man they wrote about in that paper in Cambridge. Are we walking in the light?